See, how does it go? I refuse to answer this question on the grounds of it.
Oh, all right. We just take one out and you want me to start? You want to start? Often, is this on? Often we read, critics of AA cite the poor effectiveness of our program as compared to the early years. If we concede their point, what do you feel is the single greatest challenge hurdle that caused this, and what can be done about it? Well, I think it was bringing in alcoholics that were under 49. I mean, when you're just about to die, there's a bigger odds that you'll stick around. And we didn't have treatment centers to plant a lot of different thinking in people's minds so that there are ideas. Well, there's this idea and that idea and this idea, and then I come to AA and then my sponsor's telling me this, and yes, that's true, but I have all these other thoughts that I got indoctrinated with, which wasn't going on. I mean, you just arrived and got a sponsor and we're right into God right out of the get-go. So I would say those are two. And Jared, can you think of some more that are...
I think your first point, I think the alcoholics that they approached initially that came to AA were really, really as bottom of the barrel as you can get for the most part. And they were dead serious about it. There was no hope that there was any other solution. And today we have psychiatrists who tell people that they can help their alcoholism. We have all kinds of things. But in the days that Alcoholics Anonymous started, I think those people were pretty silent because nobody had ever had the solution for the alcoholic. They had tried asylums, they had tried jails, they had tried everything they could, and nothing worked. And there was dead seriousness about it. It was viewed as a miracle in those days. We get so many people sober today that it's still just as much a miracle as it ever was. It's just that we have so many of them. So we get kind of contemptuous of the whole thing.
Yeah, and as Clancy said, we also get alcoholics not of our type. not a joke. It is that there are other situations where people get court ordered here, and there's just a whole variety. So it's awful hard to tell how much less successful. I think people like to just talk about that. I don't like to think about it. Absolutely, you take these steps, you will have the promises come true. End of story.
How do you, when do you change sponsors? In my experience, it's frequently. and when they tell you to do something you don't want to do, that's... isn't this an honest program? I think it is.
I change them every 42 years, whether I need to or not.
I change them when they die. And I've had several die. But seriously, I always tell people that I sponsor that I'm easily hired and easily fired. I think there's a great deal of advantage to staying with one sponsor. I think that you get the philosophy. If you get a good pick, you need to find someone you really may not like them very much, but if they look like they're working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you... that's who you ought to get. You don't want to get somebody you identify with. The guys you identify with drink Jim Beam on Saturday night. get somebody you don't identify with, but who has a kind of life that you'd kind of think might be possible for you. And when you change, when do you change? I think you have to listen to your heart. You have to decide whether or not you're going in the right direction with this person or not, and whether the two of you are meshing spiritually or otherwise.
Well, when I think back, the sponsor was the guy that came to your house to get you. You didn't select. It was pre-selected by whoever got that phone call to come over and get you. And when I look back on it, I think that made it a lot easier on new people, because I can't imagine what it's like to pick a sponsor. This is just me. It would be like picking parents. You know, okay, I want to make sure I get good parents and all of that. So I advanced this idea years ago. It was voted down unanimously, but I'll continue to throw it out. And that is, we have a bowl in the middle of the home group, and all the names of the sponsors are in there. And the new guy comes in, and we go, okay, it's time for Jerry to get a sponsor. Or Harry to get a sponsor. All right, come on up, Jerry. And it kind of looks like God chose it, and but that it's never going to work. Oh, my turn.
You're up.
Sandy and Jerry, what is your current resentment? Boy, that's No, it's like I don't keep them very long. There's something that is, if I don't get rid of it that day, there's something wrong. I mean, why keep it beyond one day? And so when I think about this, I just wish I was further awakened, but that's not like a resentment, but it is the biggest thing. I just believe that I get rid of it before I go to bed.
I don't need it. I think I remember it. Okay. I don't know whether to, is this a note to me or is this a I can't think of any. I'm uncomfortable with some things. I've got leukemia. I've had prostate cancer. I've got a little heart problem. I had a stroke 2 weeks ago. I dislike failing health. I resist aging. Don't want to age. But I know absolutely it's inevitable, and any time I spend with it, and not very long ago, I was thinking about these problems that I've had, and I decided, and I've been true to this, that I'm not going to spend one more day worrying about, I'm not going to let my health ruin one more day. I'm going to enjoy the damn day, and if my health takes it out, that's just the way it's going to be, but I'm not going to spend any time with it. And I think the purpose of the eighth and ninth step, is to get your life free of resentment. You ought to be able to go anywhere, anytime, and sit down next to anybody and be reasonably comfortable. You don't have to like them, but you don't want to be where you feel like you got to avoid them or you're going to be uncomfortable sitting next to them. And when you do that, your life really gets pretty free. Thank you.
Yeah. On resentments, if I can just add, just by way of example, let's suppose that you're dealing with this resentment. Your wife just ran away with your best friend. Now, that's a pretty good resentment. And you are furious. You're absolutely furious. Your life is just absolutely turned inside out. So the question is, just hypothetically, can you imagine 5 years from now being completely over it and forgiving both of them? Can you imagine that? If you can, why wait? You've already decided to let them off the hook. It's just when. And the reason we don't let them off the hook early is that we've decided as punishment we will suffer for roughly 2.5 years, and then we'll let them off the hook.
2.5 years?
Whatever.
It's a long sentence.
Yeah.
This is related. Sandy and Jerry, could you share your thoughts about forgiveness, specifically pending with fourth step resentments, dealing with the loss of a loved one due to a homicide, a child or a parent, etc.? To be honest with you, that hasn't happened to me. So what I'm talking about is theory. I don't know how to answer that. I can say this. There's two or three things that I think. I think acceptance, I think surrender, and I think forgiveness are gifts from this power. I don't know how you get a guy to surrender. I don't know how you make a person accept where they are. And I don't know how you can get anyone to forgive anyone. The only thing I know about forgiveness is that if I look at my part in the deal and I recognize that they're just as fallible as I am, I've made mistakes, they've made mistakes. After I've done my fourth step and seen what I've done to my life and to the lives of others, that's a good place for me to think about forgiving someone else. Now, I don't know what went on with the guy that killed this person. I don't know, have any idea. I've never done that. And I don't know whether they're sick. I think they must be very sick. And you know, we got a prayer that we say for a sick person in the fourth step. So I can't answer that. I think you just got to look at it and recognize that this person was not themselves, or was if they were themselves, it was a very sick person, and pray, just pray for that forgiveness is all I know.
I'd say this, in 06, the single greatest event in the world, as far as I was concerned, was the Amish forgiveness of the shootings. And that day, going over to comfort the family of the killer. I had tears in my eyes when I read about that and saw what is humanly possible in the spiritual world. So I'll just throw that up for a role model as a goal. In other words, if you answer the question that eventually you're going to forgive them, then what's the deal? Why not today? You understand what I'm saying? It's ridiculous to go, yeah, eventually I am going to totally forgive them and let them off the hook. But for now, I'm going to stay miserable and out of touch with my higher power, because I think that's really the best thing I could do. That would fall in the category, and Bill uses this word a lot in the big book, stupid. That would be stupid.
And if you decide you're never going to forgive them,
yeah,
that's a lot like being a victim. If you're going to be a victim, you really have to decide, I'm never going to have a good day. I'm always going to be ruined. I can't recover. I'm always going to be a cripple. And you're certainly not going to have any fun in this life. So you got some choices to make. If you want to be a victim, if you want to carry a resentment forever, you know, it's like holding a rattlesnake. He's yours. And you can hold him as tight as you want to.
I don't know why that reminds, but I was at a convention somewhere, and there were some young women were talking. I overheard them, and one of them said to the other, "I've never been so mortified in my life." And I just hadn't heard that sentence in a while. I think that she may have been talking about her wedding, and something happened. And Polly Pistol was there, who's one of our great women speakers. So just as for the heck of it, later I went up to her and I said, Polly, when's the last time you were humiliated? And she went, wow. I think it was 1978. I said, nothing has happened to you since 1978 to cause you to be humiliated? She says, I just don't do humiliation. That's the point. It's not what happens, it's the reaction to it. That's where the freedom is. You can't control the event, you can control the reaction to it. Your turn to draw one, I think.
I'm going to draw a white one. We've been playing on the yellow ones a lot.
Okay.
Sandy mentioned that last 3 years were filled with spectacular growth and revelations, I guess it is. Any particular catalyst for this?
Oh, okay. It's hard to explain, but I think it had to do with an increased level of seeking. In other words, I just said, I really want to see how far this can go. And so I started doing a lot of outside reading. I started going, where are all the teachers in the world? What is possible? And it was as if I took and opened up my horizon to this. And it's just blown my mind, the new perspectives that have come in and insights and whatever you want to call it. And I just feel that these 3 years have been... I just walk around amazed, you know, almost on a daily basis at how simple everything is. And I realize that the reason it's simple is that I'm not complicating it, that it always was simple. And that I was, I'll talk about it tomorrow, but that I was playing a joke on myself to complicate everything. Anyway, that's it. Well, that was for me, so you got to draw one that
no,
you can
do. Oh. I'm not going to draw it low in.
Watch this. Jerry.
I didn't think he's that smart.
Okay. Oh. Do you ever get to the place where you just know that you can stay sober forever? Okay. Now, I'm going to give you an answer. Yes. But I have to tell you why. And that is because I stay sober today. And it's today forever. There's never anything other than today. There's no future. There's just my story about the future. And there's no real past. There's just my story about the past. In other words, if I'm sitting here just having a wonderful time and then somebody says, geez, have you thought about your future? How do you think about your future? Did you ever think about that? You said, geez, I guess I will think about it. So you go back to your room and you imagine some future. Let's see, this shit could happen. And that could happen. And that could happen. Oh, man, I'm in deep trouble. Where did that come from? Well, I went back to my room, made up a terrible story, and now I feel awful. But don't go walking out of here misinterpreting that, saying, oh yeah, you can stay sober forever. It has to be understood that it is just one day at a time, which means forever. I don't know.
You reach a point, I have reached a point. When I'm around people who drink, I am very grateful. I am so grateful that I don't have to do that. It just, I can't imagine in my own mind when I would get to a place where that would be attractive to me again. I just don't want to do it. Nothing about it rings true to me. Now, will that be, as you just heard, will that last forever? I don't have any idea. But that's the way it is with me today. It's your draw.
Is it?
Did I just get faked out? Okay. I feel like a witness and I'm slowly being... I'll be sliding back to my seat in a minute. I've heard that AEA is not a religious program. What is the difference between religious and spiritual? Well, the most obvious difference is that religions have a very clear definition of the higher power. I mean, that is the landmark characteristic of almost all religions, is that you come there and they say, do you want to hear about God and who he is and the history and the miracles and all of that? But you could be in a religion and still be spiritual. So in other words, there's an element of spirituality in all religions. But a purely spiritual program like AA lays out a group of spiritual principles which will cause a spiritual experience. The experience itself creates the understanding of the higher power. So you end up with the similar activity, but in a non-secular fashion. Or words to that effect. Oh.
All the religions that I know about have an element of exclusiveness or inclusion. Mm. If you want to be a part of my group, here is what you need to believe or assert. And once you do that, you're in. If you don't do that, you better not talk about it or you're out. Sort of. Not that they exclude you physically or anything, but to fold in, you really need to be kind of a part. And that may be a large part of the trouble in the world today. That idea that we have the way. And I'm not talking about all churches. Some churches are very liberal in their thoughts about other religions. But even those churches have certain tenets that they think are very important, and that people that belong to their church subscribe to. That's what I think. You know, I read it one time, and C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Wormwood Papers.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, the little devil reports that the big devil were in a lot of trouble. Man has just found the truth. And the big devil says, don't worry about it. We're going to help him organize it. And that's what I think religions have turned out to be.
That's wonderful. Which is why Bill cautioned us to never say AA is the only way to get sober.
Right.
It's the very same thing. He said if there's other things that work, we ought to applaud them, support them, and say wonderful. None of them have showed up yet, but... We'd never want to go around saying AA is the only answer to alcoholism.
Well, this is a lot like the first one you answered. Did you ever get to where you never want to drink it? When do you know when you have, parentheses, broken through to the other side, close paren, and got the program and highly doubt that you will never use again? When do you get there? It's like saying how long is a string? Everybody has got to measure their own string on here. I don't know when I got there. I don't even know the day I quit craving a drink. I just know that, like the book says, one day I woke up and realized that for a little while, I hadn't wanted to drink. I'd driven by liquor stores and not thought about going in. And that came to me not in a flash of lightning or anything. It just happened one day. It just happened, as the book says. We didn't think about giving up the drink. We just, one day it just kind of went away. And I think this is a lot like that. When you break through, you know, we have to take action. But this is more a program of acceptance. And acceptance is kind of an inertia. I mean, there's not a lot of inertia to acceptance. You're there. You just suddenly soaks in that here I am. And here the world is, and I'm okay. I'm where I ought to be.
I'm reminded of the section in the Big Book where it says, "We have not even sworn off.
Yeah.
We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality. It suddenly is not even an issue, and that is freedom." Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Who knows when it's going to happen? But one of the things to do is to not be demanding that it happen right away, or it'll never happen. So we just accept the fact that it hasn't happened yet and move on, enjoying life until it does happen.
And I think one important thing for me was to give up the idea that I am being deprived of something.
Yeah.
That I'm giving up something. That night I had that experience where I got the thought, "Ain't you got it tough, cowboy?" That was the night that I broke through. That was the night I felt, I ceased to feel like I'm a martyr, that I've been forced into something that I don't want to. Why me, Lord? Why me? That was the night I said, "Thank you, Lord. Thank you for setting me free." That's all good as answers I can give you.
That's great. Who, me?
You.
Oh, Sandy, tell us about Lenny. Wow, that brings tears to my eyes. Okay, 5 minutes. Lenny was a street person in Washington, D.C., who came from West Virginia and was very disarming to know. There was just that aura of, is he sane or not sane? And, you know, he looked around and he was very strong and sort of redheaded Irish guy. But he desperately wanted to stay sober, so he would be at the meetings. And when I first met him, I was very put off by him because he frightened me. And so I just would go, "God, why is that guy at the meeting? He's making me nervous, and he's up and down. He couldn't sit still. He's over here. He's over there." But as I listened to him talk, he had his higher power was a squirrel. And he thought that squirrels were great higher power because they knew all about nuts, and he was a nut. And so,
kids got logic.
Yeah. And so then he'd share what the squirrel told him. And I found myself listening to the advice that he had gotten from the squirrel with great interest. And so did everybody else. I can remember when he had about 4 years sobriety, there was a United States senator who came to the Saturday morning meetings, and I wish I had a camera. And this a senator was Harvard graduate, Harvard Law School, clerk for a Supreme Court justice, no slouch. And I'm looking out in the parking lot, and Lenny is explaining to him how you talk to the squirrels. And he is listening with great interest. It was just the classic open-mindedness that we find in AA. But the So one day, we had a snowstorm. The snow was rapidly melting, and Lenny wanted to ride back to Georgetown. So I'm driving with Lenny, and I decided to make some conversation. Never having lived on the street myself, I say, "Wow, Lenny, you must be glad that this snow is melting." And he said, "Oh, yeah, that's okay, but I really prayed for it." And I immediately made a snap judgment that this man is not too bright to live in the streets and pray for snow. So teasing him on, I said, "Lenny, why in God's name would you pray for snow?" And he said, "Well, when I was a little boy in West Virginia going to school, and then it would snow at night, and we'd wake up, and there was so much snow they'd have to cancel school. And it was the happiest day." And he said, "I think kids are probably like that today, so I just wanted to give them a present." And I sat in the car going, "Now, let's see, who's the student and who's the teacher?" And the hard part of the story is that he couldn't stand if he was in the corner and then people got, so all of a sudden he felt trapped there. He'd have to push through. And he pushed through some girls at the club out of this claustrophobia feeling, and they started complaining that Lenny was causing a problem and should ban him from the club and everything. It didn't happen, but him just hearing those words, you know, that he had frightened them, really upset him. And then one time when he had a slip, he accidentally cut his sponsor's lip, who was trying to help him with something very minor. His sponsor didn't even care, but he remembered that. And he was in and out, and then he disappeared, and nobody knew where he was for a year. And I got a call one time. He's in Catonsville, which was the mental institution over between Washington and Baltimore. So I went over there to see him. And the first day, they had him on all the pills and stuff, and it was, but I wonder what he's doing in the nut ward instead of the alcohol place. So later when I went back and I could visit with him alone and everything, I said, "Lenny, what are you doing in the mental part?" And he said, "Well, they sent me through the 28 days alcohol program, and then they were sending me back to a halfway house in Washington. But I thought about the fact that if I went back there, I might be in the club sometime and scare those girls again. And I never know for sure if I might accidentally hurt my sponsor. And I just can't live with that. I am never going to hurt another person in my life. So I ran my head through a plate glass window so they would think I was crazy and keep me here so that I never hurt anybody." Now, those are strange values, but look what he was willing to do to live up to them. I still cry when I think about Lenny, and I don't really know what happened to him after he got out of there, but he's one of my great teachers, and thanks for asking about him. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Please comment on a healthy level of selfishness. Keep in mind that you are talking to an alcoholic who, even though he was selfish and self-centered to the extreme, neglected himself physically, spiritually, emotionally, and financially. Why don't you take this one?
I don't understand the beginning of it.
Well, he's saying, I believe, and I could be wrong, but I think what he's saying, Bill talks in the book, and I think it's in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, where he talks about the instincts of the human being. We have a preservation instinct. And in that preservation instinct, there must be an element of caring for yourself, of not stepping off a bridge, of not picking up the rattlesnake, of, you know, those kinds of things. And to be at least that thoughtful of yourself is a is considered by anybody that I know as normal. And to not be interested in that kind of thing is to be considered abnormal. And I think we all have to look into self-preservation and to caring for ourselves. We can't be of service to other people unless we are reasonably careful about taking care of ourselves. You just can't ignore your well-being and be able to perform as a functioning human being. So I think we all owe ourselves that much concern. I don't know that that's even selfish. I think that's just sort of built into the system, built into us to a form of intuition that we know that we have to eat, we have to sleep some, we have to not stick our head through plate glass windows. We have to be self-aware enough that we don't harm ourselves so that we can at least be useful to other people. I hope that answers the question.
That's what I was saying. You're up. I just don't think it was being selfish to take care of yourself. Right. That's what I agreed. Do you suggest working the steps over and over? Well, let's put it this way. If we use the analogy that the steps are like notes on the piano, you probably are going to use them over and over as you play different songs. They become part of how to live. I mean, it's just these are the principles that get played now. So you look at a situation and you intuitively play a certain step, only you don't consciously go number four, you know what I'm saying? But it just becomes built in to do these. And when we're disturbed, we know we have made a mistake, like hitting off key. You're playing, wrong note. And that's how we know that we made a mistake and we are off principle. And then we do whatever it takes to get back in harmony, whether we can figure it out ourselves or we have to ask somebody else. That's my shot.
I think, too, that when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there were people who said, you know, you only have to do the first nine steps one time. That's all you ever have to do them. And from then on, you're on the maintenance steps, which are 10, 11, and 12. Well, as I read 10, it sends me back through 1 through 9. So I don't know whether it makes any difference whether I'm calling it working 1 through 9 or whether I'm working step 10 as it's described in the book. The fact is, I have to go through my life looking at whether I'm powerless over something, whether I'm my life's unmanageable, whether whether God can take care of the situation I'm in. I have to inventory and look for self-centeredness if I'm going to stay on the track. So I don't know that there's a lot of difference in that view and the view that, you know, I keep working the steps. I keep applying the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life as best I can on a daily basis. That's what causes me to grow and process life in such a way that I hopefully mature and grow as a human being and as a spiritual being. So that's what I think about.
Was that mine? I read that.
No, you didn't. Did you read that?
Yeah, I read that. Did I read that?
Yeah.
Okay, I read that.
Come on, guys. He's doing such a good job. I like to listen.
Oh.
Do you think? Yeah, sometimes. We should go back to the old-time way of not allowing newcomers to participate in a discussion meeting. Well, I've never been in a group where newcomers were not allowed to participate in a discussion meeting. Our problem has always been to get newcomers to participate in a discussion meeting, to find out where the hell they are, what they're afraid of, what's going to happen. I don't think for a minute that the newcomer has much to offer except his concern for working the program, raising a question that he may have about what he's going to do in his life, and that sort of thing. He's not going to, you know, save any souls particularly. But I like to have them in the meeting, and I like to have them doing things. So, I guess I would answer the question. I wouldn't go back to saying you can't talk in a meeting.
I don't know if that came from my sharing my beginning when they were mostly speaker meetings, and my sponsor wanted me to learn how to listen, which was one of the advantages, excuse me, of mainly going to speaker meetings. And then after a certain amount of time had passed, when we would ride back in the car, and then I'd ask all the questions about what I heard at the speaker meeting and get these answers so that I now had a certain base to participate in discussing something at a discussion meetings, because we didn't have, has anybody got a problem? That was never a topic at the discussion meetings that I went to. You follow what I'm saying? Which that's entirely different. That's really in now. Who had something happen to you at work today? And then it just goes, it was always, tonight's topic is the promises. Would you please share your experience on the promises? I don't know if I'd go back to the old thing. I mean, I'm happy the way everything is. Even when the meeting gets all screwed up, I just go, hey, that's pretty cool. So I wouldn't go back to anything.
Go ahead, yeah.
Huh?
Keep on going, yeah.
Yeah. Now you read that one, right?
I did.
Okay. Anonymity question. What is your opinion on using your last names in an AA meeting? That is not a break of anonymity. If that's what the question is, does that break anonymity to use your last name at an AA meeting? I do it all the time. But I won't use your last name. I will be very careful to not break your anonymity. And of course, this is at the only place that the program suggests some guidance is at the level of press, radio, and films. And so if I go to a high school and they want, you know, somebody to come over there and talk to the high school students about AA, and it's just me and the students, I'm telling them who I am and I'm in AA and this is what happened and so on down, because I'm still not up at the level of press, radio, and films. Or I could just say I'm Sandy, because I just like doing it that way. But I, myself, if I know you, you know I'm in AA in about the first 20 minutes. Because I have found that when I work